Hey there, I'm Heather Mulder, a former AmLaw 100 partner who just 5 years into my legal career found myself teetering on the edge of burnout. So that I didn't become yet another attorney burnout statistic, I decided it was time to redefine success from the inside out. Fast forward a few years and it worked. I had a thriving legal career balanced with a fulfilling life. What I learned is that you can achieve the success you want without sacrificing yourself in the process. And I'm on a mission to help you do exactly that. Join me each week for practical, unfiltered advice on how to successfully navigate the challenging legal market and succeed in both law and life. This is the Life in Law Podcast. Well, hello, hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Life in Law Podcast. Today, I want to introduce you to our guest, Randy Rosenblatt. Randy is a passionate business developer, networker, connector, idea generator, and corporate lawyer who gained her experience in both private practice and in-house before transitioning out of the practice of law. After being instrumental in successfully growing Bliss Lawyers, a legal secondment firm, and helping with its acquisition by industry leader Axiom, Randy launched Upward Stride to bring her experience, expertise, and enjoyment in helping others level up their business development efforts and results. Upward Stride is a business development consulting, training, and coaching firm that works with law firms and individual attorneys to enhance their business development skills, strategies, and execution, leading to greater opportunities to scale. Welcome, Randy.
Thank you for having me, Heather. It's a pleasure to be here.
I'm very excited about today's conversation. But before we get into the main topic, I'd love to step back and learn a little bit more about you and kind of what made you want to get into the law in the first place. And then, of course, the transition out. But why don't we start with what made you want to be a lawyer? What made you go to law school in the first place?
Sure. So it's probably not something you typically hear. Maybe it is, but kind of way back when, elementary school, probably, I was a big fan of Law and Order. And that's actually kind of where it started. I probably enjoyed the police work of that show more than the lawyer work. I just didn't realize at the time. But that was kind of what had kind of given me the idea. After I graduated college, I wasn't 100% sure. So I actually took 2 years off and I moved back to New York, where I'm from, and worked as a real estate analyst for those years, and then was able to basically say, you know what, I do want that education. I do want that experience. I did go to law school to practice law. That was what I was planning to do. I would say probably within my first year, I realized that my interest in Law and Order was more the police work than the legal work. But I wrote it out.
That's interesting. So you say that it's not normal, your story as to why, which it isn't. I hear a lot of different reasons, but it's actually more comparable to my reasoning. So I don't know if you've heard that I watched the show called The Paper Chase early on, which is actually about being in law school. Mm-hmm. And for whatever reason, that got me hooked on, oh, this sounds really interesting. And I don't know what that says about me, given, you know, the storyline of that show, but and right. It definitely ages me knowing that show. But it was a television show that got me hooked initially and made me want to be a lawyer. So
yeah, I think it's a little different in practice than on the show, for sure, in either case. But here we are.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So, OK, so you went through a law school. You did well.
I actually went through law school and business school simultaneously.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So my law school story is a little bit unique also. I went to law school at Tulane in New Orleans. And before we started classes, my 2L year, Hurricane Katrina hit.
Okay.
So we evacuated. I spent that semester at UCLA, where they graciously opened their doors for us for the semester. And then when I went back to Tulane, I had kind of always had business in my mind, but didn't know if I'd ever actually do it. And I actually ran it. I remember clearly I ran into a friend in the library and I'm like, what are you doing? He's like, oh, I'm studying for the GMAT. And I'm like, oh, you're thinking of going to business school? And he's like, yeah. I was like, you know, I want to sit for the GMAT? I'm doing all this law school stuff. He's like, Randy, like, you sat for the LSAT, you're going through law school, like, this is easy. And I was like, okay. And it was on my radar anyway. So I sat through the GMAT. Long story short, I ended up applying to the business school. So I did 2 years of law, then 1 year of business. And then my fourth year was both.
So you did it the hard way. But I see inklings of business there, which is probably telling for the rest of your story, yeah, right?
Absolutely.
So like everybody else, you then had to get a job. What were the factors you considered when you were looking at, you know, the different places you could go, what kind of law you wanted? I always find it fascinating what people consider and what they don't.
Yeah. So I, given that I had this interest in business, and I actually also thought early on that perhaps I'd go in-house, maybe go for a general counsel seat at some point, I picked the area of law that was most versatile. And to me, that was corporate. Mm-hmm. It spanned enough different areas. It was broad enough, yet could be specific enough. And given that I went to law school and my MBA has a focus in finance, it made a lot of sense. And I had debt, and big law was the way to go, honestly, right? Like, at least for a couple of years, let me, you know, go do that and see what it's about. And you can never challenge big law training, frankly, for, you know, all the pros and cons. Like, you are well-trained coming out. You are detailed, and your T's are crossed and your I's are dotted. So that's what I was going after. I actually summered at a firm that was wonderful. I loved it and got an offer to join, accepted it. And the long story short is that firm, on my way out of my fourth year of grad school, was on the verge of implosion.
Oh no.
Yeah. So, you know, no story is seamless, right? So fortunately, I am actually still in touch with a hiring partner from that firm, and she's wonderful, but I kind of saw the writing on the wall. So I re-entered the interview ring while I was in my last semester, basically, of grad school, and ended up ultimately rescinding my acceptance from that firm, joining a different firm where I did start as a first year. And that first firm ultimately did collapse that October.
Wow.
So
we could probably guess who it was, but
unfortunately, they weren't the only one, but they were one of the first, which mm-hmm. seemed like a nightmare time. But as someone coming out of law school, it ultimately ended up being a blessing, because I didn't have so much competition in the sense of everyone was going through this at the same time. We were like kind of the first. Mm. But you, Heather, know how it is, right? Like, you've done everything as right as you can going through grad school, and you secure this job that you've been after. And if you lose it, you're at a disadvantage kind of coming out, right? You're not mm-hmm. where you be, and getting that first job is important in a lot of ways, right? You don't always know when or how, but again, no one can challenge a job like that and the training you're going to get. So when it was in jeopardy, it was definitely daunting.
Yeah. And I think because those of us who go into law school, like, we like to check the boxes, right? We check the box to take the LSAT, and then we get in and we go to law school and we follow the steps, and then we go through the interview process, and then you supposedly get your job and you know what it is for a while. And then, like, you just follow all those steps, and then it gets pulled from you and you're like, whoa, wait, what?
Yeah.
Yeah. Which, honestly, it's funny to me, because in talking over the years, and especially now with this podcast and in my coaching, something I've learned, there is a definitive advantage to some of the people that might not be in that, like, top 10 to 15% that get into the interview process at some of these schools, because those of us who got those advantages usually were in the top, like, 10, 15, 20, 25%, very much depends on the school you're in, whereas everybody else often is kind of like having to come up with their own and having to figure it out. And it's interesting to me, the advantages yet disadvantages of having that versus the advantages and disadvantages of not getting that. Because I do think you learn different lessons, right? And some of the people who didn't, you know, they might not have been at the top of their class for whatever reason, it was a disadvantage in some ways, but yet the process of them getting out there and being more independent and doing their own thing and feeling like they had to kind of do it on their own helped them in ways that a lot of the big law attorneys don't. There's something not created in them. You know what I mean?
I do, because I will tell you, I fall into that group. I was not, and I'm very open about this, I was not in the top 10% of my class. And so there was a list of firms that I was not on their list because I was not in that top 10%. So the firm I was going to hired me because they saw something in me. And I so appreciated that. And that's how I kind of being on this side this many years out, that's kind of how I view it. There's a load of people that were on law review that I would never hire, right? Like, you just, sure, they can write their legal briefs and they can take their legal test. Are you going to put them in a room with your clients?
No.
Right?
Yeah. No, there were definitively people like that.
Right. So going through and kind of finding this firm who's like, you may not be top 10%, but Randy, like, you're awesome. And we want you as a colleague and you hustle and you can figure this out and you have the right attitude. That's the firm I wanted to go to. Right.
Right.
So, and it is a harder journey. I was in a tier one school, but I went to school in the South. I was coming back up to New York. So
that makes it harder.
It makes it harder, except for the fact that Tulane has a good reputation and a solid alumni base up here. And it was important that I was in the top tier of law schools to come back. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. We have great, I'm back in New York now. We have amazing law schools here, right? So it's competitive. Anyway, I was really fortunate to have had the opportunity to summer at that firm and to potentially start at that firm. And then frankly, when it was imploding, it was still on my resume that that's where I was going, right? So it had a check in the right box, right?
Right,
that firm wanted her. Okay, they're imploding. We'll take her, right? So.
Yeah, it's just interesting though. And I wanted to highlight, like, for those of you, and I have a client now who she's actually at the end of her law school experience. I mostly work with people who are practicing and have been practicing a while, but she reached out to me very smartly. She's also older. She's a mom of children. She owns her own business. This is her second career. And, you know, she felt weird about, I don't know about the whole big law experience. My grades aren't quite there because she has this other business she's running, by the way, and a full family and all these things that most law students don't. And I'm like, yeah, but I think this is a good thing for you because I don't think you actually need big law based on who you are. And I think you're going to be very successful in the long run. And I think, you know, I look back at a lot of my colleagues and most are doing pretty well, but some of the most successful did not start at the top of the class and in the big law ranks. And so I would say to anybody out there, regardless of where you are, it's ultimately up to you. And understanding that there are things you need to learn and you need to get scrappy. And if you don't, you know, at some point, all of us get the rug pulled out from under us. It's just a matter of when and where and how. And there's a lot to be learned through that. And take what you can learn from it and move forward. So
yeah. I think there are benefits to being one of those folks too, right? Like you have a seat in a litigation very early on at those kind of small scrappy shops that you're not going to get in big law, if ever.
Right.
Right. And that's kind of, and small scrappy shops, you always got to go figure it out. Whereas in big law, oftentimes it's already figured out. Right. So pros and cons each and interesting journeys for everyone, you know, regardless of which path they choose.
So it sounds like you did private practice for a while. You did in-house. What were the varying, thought processes that went through when you decided, okay, I want to go in-house versus I want to be in private practice?
Sure. So I actually knew pretty early on in my firm, I was at two big firms, and I knew pretty early on that I didn't want to go for a partner. It was not kind of what my, you know, trophy looked like. Mm-hmm. For various reasons. There was more that I was hoping to do in different ways and more creative ways and whatnot. I actually had thought of leaving the practice from the firms, but like I mentioned before, in-house kind of was always on my mind. And then I had an opportunity to join the Heineken legal team, which was, as everyone told me, people 30 years my senior, partners at my firms, like, wow, that is my dream job, Randy. That is the coolest job ever. And I was like, yeah, I mean, you're a lawyer for a beer company. Like, that sounds like a party every day and like super fun and interesting and whatnot. So I went over and it was all those things. And the organization was really fun and doing cool stuff, but I was still the lawyer. And that was kind of where I decided actually to leave the practice. And I'm so glad I went over to take that role, because if that wasn't going to kind of light me up and excite me, then I was very confidently leaving the practice to find what would, kind of having had that experience.
Okay, I love that you highlighted that because one of the things I hear a lot from people who aren't sure whether they want to stay lawyers or not is, well, you know, I don't want to try something and it be wrong. I don't want to go, you know, and I'm like, you know, you're looking at it the wrong way. It's the next step you need to get more clarity around what it is you do want. And sometimes you need that step in between. Totally. And I love that you were at a private practice, another private practice, you know, two firms, and you clearly decided, okay, I'm pretty clear I don't want partnership. Now let's try something else. And then, because that was always in the back of your mind. And as most humans, if you had just jumped and done something else and not done that, you might have always wondered in the back of your mind. But this gave you that clarity of, yeah, no, this is not what I want either.
I mean, I was lucky to have it, right? And it's interesting. I guess on a personal note, I met my husband in grad school and we went through law school and business school together. And we started both as corporate lawyers at different firms on the same exact day. And that was the last day our careers were the same. And I saw him kind of growing up through his work, and he's a deal junkie and he loved it. And he had that energy and that adrenaline. And I always say, like, I wanted my deals to die by Friday. I really did. And it's like, I wouldn't want me on that team. Like, whether I'm a good lawyer, it doesn't matter. Like, if I don't want to be doing this, and I see someone very close to me, the closest person to me who loves this, like, that's who should do this work. Mm-hmm. So that for me was really helpful, kind of in addition to having the dream job, you know, working at Heineken, to say, like, I'm very comfortable to say, this is not for me. I had not, in all fairness, figured out what was for me, but I knew I liked the legal industry. I liked being surrounded by lawyers. I liked the intellect. I liked all that stuff. But I liked all the non-billable stuff, right? So, and then I'm sitting there thinking, okay, so I'm still paying this debt and all the stuff I like has nothing to do with my 4 years of grad school that I can kind of pinpoint. So where am I going here, right? I did not have the next step. I mean, I had it figured out when I left Heineken, but when I decided to leave, I didn't have it figured out.
So how did you figure that out?
So it's very fun. I feel like every question you're asking is prompting some unique and different story. Maybe it's why you do what you do here. But so I kind of sat down and I made a T-chart about the things I like about what I do and the things I don't like about what I do. And then I went onto LinkedIn and I had conversations with people in all different types of roles, kind of learning more about what they do. And I went onto LinkedIn and I started just putting in different search terms. So at one point I thought about M&A integration, like when companies merge and they have to kind of get all their processes and everything integrated, could that be interesting? Anyway, I kind of went through this process, and Bliss Lawyers, the company where I ended up running business development, had a posting for their head of business development, and I read what they were looking for. And I literally said, this is what I need to do. They wanted someone who was going to build business, who was going to be strategic. Mind you, I didn't have traditional business development training, but I knew how to pitch. And I'd been hustling to do that at my firms when I was there. And I could have all those types of conversations, but it was interesting. They were looking for someone to run business development, generate new clients, come up with process and strategy for growth and expansion. They were a few years old at the time. And they wanted someone who had worked at firms and in-house, which I had, and someone who was a JD and an MBA, which I was. And the fifth thing was someone who had traditional business development training. And in my head, I was like, who on earth is going to have 5 out of 5 of these?
Who has traditional business development training? Because there is not much out there.
Right. I think they were looking for someone who had been on one of the BD teams at one of the law firms, honestly. But that person is unlikely to have had the other four.
Correct. That's correct.
So I applied. And they replied that, thanks for your interest, but we're also looking for someone with traditional business development training. So we're going to pass on you. And I replied, thank you for letting me know. If you decide to expand your search, here's why I'm a fit. And sure enough, 2 weeks later, they decided to expand their search. And I got hired and it worked out for both of us, right? Like, I grew this team, we grew the business, and we got it sold to Axiom February of 2020, which was kind of the ultimate compliment to what we had built and what we had created and that we were noticed in this way, right? Like we were significantly smaller, but doing things that were interesting. So
something I want to highlight about that, that you did that I think is very smart. A lot of people will hear the no thanks and not really respond or just respond to thanks for letting me know.
Yep.
You knew to, and this shows that you're good at business development because this is part of what you do at business development, y'all. You got to follow up with people. And a no is not a no forever a lot of times. It's a no for right now. And hers ended up being just a no for 2 weeks.
Right.
You know what? You can sell yourself and why and just say, okay, well, you know, if this ever comes up again or if you decide to expand, here's why I fit all the other boxes and why you should consider me. And it's just so smart. And you can relay that into all kinds of business development experiences with lawyers and the way they deal with clients. And this is something most lawyers don't do. They don't get back to people and continue to I've known so many attorneys, and I especially not so much in my practice now because I teach them not to do this, but they come in with stories like, you know, having just let go of things. But when I was practicing, I remember the number of lawyers I would see who, after just a couple of trying to get people out and trying to talk to them, not getting what they wanted, dropping them. And I'm like, are you crazy? Like, you got to actually build a relationship and you got to follow up with people. Or when they finally got a, yeah, we've decided to go with, and they drop them completely. Like, no, that's not the time you do that. You actually need to stay in touch because you never know. And how you handle that makes an impact on them if you handle it the right way.
Absolutely. I mean, I agree with everything you said, and I actually work with my clients in the same way. You know, I have a client who will forward me an email of, you know, something they were trying to pitch. And to your example, the potential client went in a different way. They'll send it along, Randy, ugh, forget it, blah, blah, blah. It's like, they replied to you. What do you mean forget it? They may not have chosen you for this, but the difference is going to be what you do now versus what the other people they didn't choose, right? Whoever they chose could be the wrong fit. They may have another need down the line. They may need actually extra support. Like, there's a million things that could happen.
This person who was integral in that process may move somewhere else, and your response here might help you get that later. I mean, there's so many different opportunities.
Yeah.
When a client sends me something like that, I'm curious to know, what do you do this? I don't just tell them, often like, here's how I would respond. Like, I give them... Like, you can put it in your language, but here's how I would respond.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
But a big part of it is also changing how they feel about it.
Yes. Right?
There's one client of mine. We had been after a prospective client of hers for a long time, and they kept, you know, they couldn't go to lunch and they were turned down events. And finally, and I kept saying, like, they're replying to you. They are engaged in the conversation. Yes. Don't view this as them saying, no, they're not interested. If they weren't interested, I mean, could they not be interested? Sure. Will this turn into something? Maybe, maybe not. But they don't have to respond.
Right? That's true. And right? And the point of when you're having quote unquote sales conversations or you're in that process is to keep the conversation going. The fact that they're responding you helps keep it going. So there's usually something there. Because in my experience, if they're really not interested, they will tell you or they'll totally ignore you until you go away. It's one of those two things. The number of attorneys I know out there who, well, I haven't heard back. It's been 2 weeks and I haven't heard back. I'm like, follow up again. Like, seriously, how many times do you get an email that's not an urgent thing, especially if it doesn't relate to a current deal or something, and you don't get back and you intend to, but then several weeks go by and you totally have forgotten about it? Like, that's happening to them too. Stop assuming.
Right. You know, I did a whole LinkedIn post about this because it was happening. I was having so many conversations. I think the likelihood is it's probably not you, right? Mm-hmm. The likelihood is they're busy. They're wrapped up in something else. They're on vacation. They're under a tight deadline. Like, the odds are that it's not you. And it's interesting because I'll have clients who say, well, like, why, like, how could I respond again? Like, they wrote this. And I was like, you literally have nothing to lose because right now you have nothing.
That's so right.
You're going to end up in the same spot. The only thing that could happen is something potentially good. So why are you not?
Yeah, that is so key. And I think everybody out there needs to try to find that mentality shift within them. Because when you shift your mentality in that way, you approach so many things in such a different way. You open up more opportunities very quickly for yourself that you don't realize exist. And you come across very differently when you do respond. You're just in a very different place.
And you're not top of mind, right? Like, right. So if you're, it's so funny. I have a partner for my work with, she has a client and she's like, Randy, it's the strangest thing. Like every time I send her an email on something or invite her to something, she ends up sending me work. Like, it's like so ironic. And I'm like, it is absolutely not ironic. No. You're popping in her inbox. She's like, oh, you know what? I should have her do this work. Or you're popping in her inbox. She's like, oh, wait, I have this project. Actually, she just emailed me. Let me shoot it over. I'm like, keep showing up. Like, just show up.
Yes. Right? So simple, right?
So many of your competitors aren't. They're waiting, right? Like, how many clients, Heather, do you have that say, well, I did that presentation and I haven't heard anything from anyone on it. I would have thought I'd get some clients. Well, I would have told you ahead of time that your presentation alone probably would not get you many, if any, clients.
You got to keep it going. It's called building a relationship, y'all, and that takes time. And, you know, it's interesting to me how so many attorneys see this when it comes to personal relationships, but professional, it's like, oh, well, I've talked to them twice. They should hire me. And like, why? They don't know enough about you after talking, like meeting you at a networking event and then you took them to lunch. Like, that doesn't mean they're going to hire you or your law firm immediately, but they're at least interested enough in getting to know you more. So keep that going. And then, of course, you have to ask. Like, that's another issue. Now, you don't ask at the beginning. That's ridiculous. Unless they're telling you they're interested, right? Or they're giving you vibes of we're in the market right now. And there are openings that you need to be aware of. But usually there's not an opening. And so you don't ask immediately. But then you do need to later on. Like, this whole let's just build a relationship and hope they send me work one day doesn't quite work that way for most people. So...
Well, I actually think also in terms of that is if you structure your conversations in a thoughtful way where you're understanding what they're working on, where their needs are, where their pain points are, and you're sharing examples of things you're doing, in some cases it could become obvious.
It becomes a really easy opening for them to ask or for you to even say, how about we take this further?
You know? Right. But even, you know, if they're talking about something and you say, you know, that's actually squarely within our work, we throw our hat in the ring. Like, it's comfortable, right? It doesn't, I think if you give enough, you probably don't have to ask a fraction of what you would if you were not constantly sharing information.
And as you said, the ask is different. It's not an outright ask. It's more like nuanced and just comfortable. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't feel like you're selling because you're really not in the same way that we think about it, right? You're just helping them and trying to continually help them and provide value and they see it.
And I think this also ends up, there's a difference for this, honestly, between men and women. And a lot of it is kind of how you grew up through high school, college, law school, and what those friends are doing now. And from a statistics perspective, your college buddies being in decision-making positions is more likely for, you know, male friends than female friends. It's just what it is right now. So those relationships have been instilled for decades, right? They don't always have to kind of start from scratch, right? It's not true in every case, but on like statistically, it is what it is, right? Yep. So understanding where you are in those relationships and what has to start from scratch and what you can build on based on years of friendship and kind of, you know, oftentimes the hardest work to get is the work from friends. So how do you actually have that conversation as well? And how early can you have it?
Yeah, no, that's definitely, we could go into a whole tangent on that, which we're not today. Maybe we'll have to have you back and we can have a conversation around that in the future. But let's move on into, you know, so you moved on, you figured out where you were, was really more of the right place.
Yes.
That place got bought. Now what? Now what do you do?
So I will say, since I moved over to the business development side of this industry, I've not felt like I've worked a day. I've loved it ever since. So I loved my time at Bliss. I loved what we built. When we got the business sold to Axiom, I joined Axiom temporarily as part of the transition to help with the clients, many of whom were mine. And build those relationships over there. But I had been seeing that and realizing that I grew this and I grew my business and no one ever talked about it in law school and no one ever talked about how to do it when I was at my law firms in any big way, right? We'd have a lunch and learn twice a year for an hour and we'd probably all go for the free food, right? Mm-hmm. And we'd go back. And then all of a sudden, I'm seeing like friends of mine who are in law school and whatnot starting to get into conversations about partnership and being asked, what is your prospective book of business look like? And nobody actually even knows what anyone's talking about, right? They're like heads down for 22, 23, 2500 hours a year and figured that was their path. And what I realized is it's not that you're either born with the ability to develop business or you're not. There's this middle ground of people who are interested in it, but just don't know how to do it. And it can be taught. And I don't think there's one way for everybody. In fact, every client I work with is different than the next. Yes. But if you figure out where you want to be in the space and you build the business in a way that's authentic to you, it's really fun. And it's not as complicated, right? I always say, like, I was in way too many cigar bars as a junior associate and I hated every second of it. And the partner was going and I tagged along and the clients were going. But like, what was I doing there? Right. Mm-hmm. It was not a good use of anyone's time, certainly not mine. And what could I have been doing different? What relationships should I have been nurturing on my own? So I, as we were kind of going through the sale process of Bliss, I said, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to start a company that focuses on this, working with lawyers, working with law firms, big and small, on how to drive revenue, right? How to scale in a way that makes sense. The strategy can't be wait for the phone to ring, right? That's not a plan.
No. And something you said though earlier that I think no law firms really don't teach people how to do this. They think they do. They think they do by telling them, like giving them these overly generic kind of so-called workshops or courses. I've known law firms to do this in different ways. At least this is what I see a lot. And this is what I saw growing up, you know. And the complaint I probably hear the most from new clients when it comes to business clients is I get what people do, right? I get the tactics, the strategies, all the things I could be doing. The real issue I have is how do I figure out what I should be doing? And then how do I find a way to create a very simple plan to keep up with it? Mm-hmm. That's where I think they need a lot. I mean, they get what they're supposed to do from a legal marketing's perspective or all the different things they could be doing, right? Everybody, we're smart. We understand that, but we don't understand. It's very hard to then determine, okay, but what works for me? How do I figure that out? And how do I fit it into my already busy schedule? And before that, how, as an associate, can I be, you know, what can I be doing to help develop the skills I need for the business I one day might need to build?
Yeah.
Which, by the way, those skills will help you regardless of whether you make partner, whether you stay in, you know, whether you go in-house. Like, they're skills that are really good to have regardless. Mm-hmm. So you want to develop them. So you mentioned that, but I don't know. I wanted to really highlight it because I think a lot of people sometimes, you know, think, well, it's just me. I'm an idiot because I don't know. I should know. And I don't, you shouldn't, because there's nobody out there helping you determine what's best for you.
Right. It's, so I think you can only ever own your career as a private practice lawyer if you have dollars next to your name.
Yes.
And if you are a service partner, you should be a service partner because it makes sense for what you've built and you've made that choice. You should not have defaulted into it. I see a lot of that, and it's because nobody's thinking about it early on, right? Like, they're 10, 15, 20 years out and they're a service partner because they just never want to develop anything. It wasn't second nature to them, right? They didn't have that hustle initially, but maybe they could have. It's something that I feel like should be, I've actually trained at my law school on this because it's something that should be talked about, in my view, pretty early on and kind of be on the radar. In terms of what you said, kind of how do I make it work for me? I'll tell you, every client I work with, I start with, who's your network? Who are your people?
Me too.
Right there. And then you figure it out, right? Like,
That's and it's amazing how quickly they realize it's bigger than they thought, because they've never just sat down and like put it like on a paper and thought through, okay, who is my network?
Right. And then I think the second thing is, right, take a litigator, right, a general commercial litigator. I'll say to my commercial litigator clients, do your friends and family know what you do? And they'll say, yeah, they know I'm a litigator. I was like, is that all they know? They're like, yeah. I was like, okay, so they have no idea actually what you do. They don't know who to introduce you to. They don't know who to refer to you, right? They're going to send you the people who are have encountered a problem that they've already hired counsel for. But, oh, my son or daughter is a litigator. You should talk to them. And then they'll come talk to you, but you're too late. Right. Mm-hmm. So what if you actually equipped your family and friends? Because that is your personal PR team, essentially. What if you actually equipped your family and friends with the information they need to actually help you grow your business? Not in a salesy type way, but hey, mom, hey, dad, hey, sister, brother, friend, spouse, whoever. I want you to know what I do. So if you actually come across someone who might value knowing me and having me as a resource, that you can make the introduction.
Simple, right?
Simple. But it's amazing how nobody does it.
It is amazing. Yeah.
Yeah. But once we talk about it, they're like, huh, you know what? You're right. You know, my spouse has no clue what I do. Right?
And if your spouse has no clue, nobody else has a clue either, right, who's outside, right, of the firm. Right.
And actually, on the flip side of that, how many people do you meet when you ask what their partner does? They say, you know, I don't really understand it. Ask him or her. Such a disservice, right? This person who wants you to succeed, these people who want you to succeed, you have to arm them with the information to help you.
Okay, so let's get into some of the things you feel law firms especially can and should be doing differently, better, whatever. Like, what do they need to know so that they can serve their attorneys better and actually help more of their people grow up through the ranks, build a business, make partner, make equity partner? You know, it's better for everybody if they're capable of doing that, right? So what do they need to know?
So I think there's a host of things, right? I think these firms are pulled in a lot of different directions, and the big ones at least have these marketing and business development teams that are essentially working as marketing teams. Mm-hmm. I think starting with the associates, introduce them to the concept of business development and what it looks like, what it means as they grew up, highlighting the fact that it is currently their job to learn how to be a lawyer, but here's what's coming. So keep in touch with those law school friends, here's why. Keep in touch with those college friends, here's why. Give them tools to do it, right? You're not going to provide the resources to your junior lawyers, in my opinion, at the same level that you're going to provide those resources to your more senior lawyers.
Right.
But
I would even go so far to say is really highlight the fact that it's up to them to keep their network and grow it. And I do not think the emphasis on dragging along young associates to these dinners and lunches and like an occasional is kind of nice if they helped with a deal or helped with a case and it's like a celebration. Yes, you should include them then. But if you're going out as a partner and you're trying to get a new client, you don't necessarily need to bring or grow a client, the young associate. It's not unless there's somebody else of their age that they can be networking with. And often there's not. I think oftentimes what I've seen happen, and this is in big law, is these younger associates get dragged to a lot of that. And so they feel like they don't need to be doing anything else. When in fact, the things they could be doing on their own would be much more beneficial to them in the long run.
Absolutely. I think also let your attorneys know what resources they have at the firm.
Yeah.
Right. I work with attorneys at big firms that have access to these business development and marketing teams. And I'll say, can your marketing team handle this? And they say, well, I don't know. And then they go ask and they're like, oh yeah, we do have that subscription, or they do have relationships with that publication. Mm-hmm. Let your attorneys know what they can call on you for and what resources the firm has, right? Are there panel seats available at different levels? Are there publication opportunities at different levels? You know, one thing I did when I was at one of my firms was I was, and I continue to be, a big proponent of building relationships at the level you're at. So if you are a second year or a fifth year, don't go target the general counsel of name your big bank or name your big pharma company, right? Because that's not where you're best to operate. You want to grow up with folks who are at your level. When you are in a position to start pitching for business, they are in a position to make a decision. So I created this event. I actually brought it to the head of the firm and had to get a budget for it, which I must have spent, days with multiple partners input on this memo. And then the managing partner gave me the budget I asked for in 6.5 minutes. But the idea was, why don't we create an associates only event where we invite our contacts, no partners are invited. And we, if I'm a second year or third year or fifth year or sixth year, whatever the case is, who are my friends and colleagues or people who have been on my deals at the banks who are at that level, at the insurance companies who are at that, at the, Fortune 500 who are at that level, and invite them to this networking event. We did, it was a wine tasting in New York City. This was a handful of years ago. We had name tags. Our team at the law firm was prepared. We knew who was coming. We knew what they did. We involved the partners at the firm in two ways. One is we did some training ahead of time with the partners on how to have conversations and how to build business, all geared towards this event. We did a panel discussion about war stories, which I think always has mixed effect, but we did it. And then the other thing we did is we said to the partners, can you ask your clients if they have anyone on their teams that would fit this? And let's invite them, right? So the partner is, works with the general counsel, and then there's an AGC on the team or a deputy, whatever the case is, would he or she like to come? So we involved them in that. So we had buy-in from everyone. That event continued even after I left the firm. It was a great way for associates to plug in. It was a great way for us to engage our network and really to kind of show the associates that you do have these relationships and people show up and they do matter. And if we continue this in 3, 4, 5, 6 years, when you are bringing in business, you've built this over time, that decision maker will come hire you.
Yes. So absolutely.
Those types of things, right? Like multifaceted ways to engage, I think are really meaningful. The partner panel with war stories, sure, once in a while, but does anyone get anything great? I think the better stories are about the business you lose than about
I don't think the war stories are all that helpful usually in the way that they're told. And unless you can really glean a lesson from it that that you can make the point clearly, I think they tend to just be fun stories people like to tell.
Right. But think about the ones that those partners, the business those partners didn't get. Why didn't they get it? What could they have done differently? Right.
That would be sharing things that a lot of partners don't like sharing.
Right.
But it would be incredibly helpful. And honestly, I would love that idea because here's why. A, you learned something from it and you can impart that lesson on other people without having to go through the same thing, because they will probably go through the same thing, right? If you don't impart the lesson in some way, shape, or form. B, it shows a human characteristic about partners that a lot of younger people, whether they be senior associates, young associates, mid-level, or even young partners, see you as more human, which actually increases the connection there and the credibility. I think that helps create a better culture at the end of the day in the firm. So I'd be all over that if you're a law firm or you're somebody high up in a firm, or I don't care where you are, but go pitch this in your firm, because you should do it.
And you know what? Every firm's going to have a couple partners that they know are going to show up for something like that and say, you know what? Let me share the worst scenario that I ever encountered, right? And honestly, you're going to build a relationship with your associates, which is another part of this, right?
Yes.
In terms of other things the firm should be doing, I think cross-selling is a huge one. Do the teams know what the other teams are capable of? And are you pitching your corporate clients on your litigation capabilities and vice versa? Are you pitching your trust and estates clients with your corporate capabilities if they're business owners or potential business owners, right? There's so much opportunity, right? So do it across lunch and learns, right? If you have a litigation lunch, every lunch you have every month, invite another team to present on their capability. So I have a client, actually, he's a corporate lawyer. He's done a lot of work for the T&E clients at the firm who have businesses. And I said, well, how did that happen? He's like, well, this T&E partner asked me this one. I was like, why don't you reach out to the head of the T&E group, trust and estates group, and ask to come to their next lunch to share what you've done to support the partners.
Yes.
Then the other ones know, right?
I would say when it comes to cross-selling, like, this is something that a lot of individual lawyers understand and get and do well. Not all, but many. Like, a lot of my clients, especially, this is something that isn't utilized enough. And so I help them quickly build a bigger book of business, quickly increase originations through this. But you are highlighting it's not enough for individual lawyers to do this. The firms need to get behind this and have a more structured approach to ensuring everybody understands what everybody does so that that can work better.
Yeah, absolutely. I think also the credit models need to be revisited, right? Like,
yes.
What does origination look like? When are you required? Like, there should be rules around sharing, and it should not be left up, left up to each partner, or each attorney. You hope everybody's going to do the right thing, but there's a sliding scale in that. So there are certain scenarios. There should be parameters around the scenarios in which you are required to share that credit, right? It's better for everyone. I mean, I don't think it can be a fine line, but there should be some stronger guidance than I've seen.
Yeah. And there needs to be more credit given to younger people who come in and really grow the relationship. I see this happening, and this happened to me, where there's a relationship, but it's not very big. Somebody already kind of has the credit on it. Somebody else comes in and really knocks it out of the park and takes it to a massively new level. And yet that original partner is getting most of the credit, which is
even when the partner leaves the firm.
It's bull. Right? It's like ridiculous.
Yeah, absolutely.
And you lose partners that way.
Absolutely.
And then they take that work with them.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Right. And it's things like that, right? Like, the partner leaves the firm, so that credit goes to the house. Well, now you have the partner here who's building it. Like, I also think, actually, tell me why this happens. You're an associate, you bring in a 7-figure client, just so happens, right? You get a pat on the back. You're a partner, you bring in a 7-figure client, all of a sudden you have origination. The money's no greener, right? It is the same money. Why are associates not compensated for
origination? Should be. They should be.
Absolutely.
And it shows, you know, if you compensate those associates appropriately, they will stick around and be loyal to you. And they're already this is what I don't understand. They're already showing they have the ability to build business.
Yeah.
Which is a huge problem with most attorneys that are like most associates. You have no clue when you're promoting into partner whether they really truly can. So if that person is, you want to keep them.
Well, and I think developing business with an associate title is very hard, right?
Oh, it's incredibly hard. It's so incredibly hard.
Even if you bring in a partner to actually secure it, and in all fairness, there are some firms that do this, but not enough, 100% not enough, but you are showing your associates that we value you and look at what you're doing. This is amazing, right? I think the other thing that firms should do is every attorney at every level at the firm should have a business development budget, not the same amount, but give your associates free rein over a fixed amount of dollars that they have to report in, right? Who they're going to their stuff with, but like $1,000, $2,000 to go take a friend who they went to law school with, who's in-house, to lunch, not have to see approval on everything. Like, give them ownership over a budget that they know. We have to let the firm know what we're doing with this, but it's ours to use. And if it's used in some way, you can have that conversation. But my guess is that it'll either be used the right way or not used most of the time. And if it's not used, ask those associates why they're not using it.
Yeah. Encourage them to use it.
Yeah. So create this culture from the beginning that business development matters. Like, that's how the lights stay on. Right?
It is. And it's, you know, there's this, and I know we're kind of running out on time, but this idea that you bill, and that's all you need to worry about. And then it's like, all of a sudden, boom, okay, now you have to think about this. And we've never taught you how. We've not even encouraged it. You've never done it. But now there's pressure. You got to build a book of business. Go have fun. Bye-bye. Right. You know, and that is how a lot of people feel when they first make partner. And then they're stuck in this limbo. And most of these firms, it's non-equity partner until they start growing a decent sized book of business. And
now they're chasing their law school friends from 10 years ago.
Yeah. And it's super hard because they've never developed the habits, nor do they have the network they could have had they just been encouraged to do it from the beginning.
And it's more comfortable for everyone, right? It's just part of the culture. I would say one other idea, and I know to your point, we're running out of time here. I think we could probably stay on here for hours talking about this stuff. Whoever is handling true business development at the firm, not the glossies, not the pitch decks and stuff, but whoever can kind of get into the weeds with your lawyers, have them set office hours a couple times a week where people can put out a sign up genius. Who wants 15 minutes to go over something? Like, make that team available, because those teams are often lean. They are flexed in a million different ways. They can't necessarily kind of come to you right when you need them and respond, but they're trained and hopefully good at what they're doing and creative and all of that. That make them accessible and do it in a way that people can let, oh, yep, I actually do have something this week. Let me see if there's a 15-minute spot they have and I can sign up and pop in, right? And the attorneys should build relationships with those marketing and business development folks. They're a huge resource that they don't necessarily even know about.
It is amazing to me how many lawyers and firms, especially the bigger firms, have no clue what the resources that are available to them are. Mm-hmm. And to someone's credit, who I recently talked to, who wants to work together, she's decided, okay, let's put this off for a couple weeks, even a couple months. I have no clue what my resources are, and I need to go spend that time and figure that out. And then we can come back together and figure out how to utilize them the best. And I'm like, yay for you, because you at least see that these resources exist and you don't know what they are, and it's time to go figure it out.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I had one partner I was working with at a big firm. She wanted to start writing more. So I said, okay, let's come up with the topic and then go to the marketing team and see where they can get this print. Mm-hmm. And she's like, they're not going to be able to get it printed. I was like, why not? She's like, because they've never told us that we can submit. I was like, let's try. Sure enough, she was an employment lawyer. She went. She ended up getting published in an HR periodical that the marketing team reached out to a bunch of different publications, and they found her a slot. They can do all this stuff, right? Are they going to work granular with each lawyer? No, it's oftentimes probably why you and I are hired, because they can't. Right. And you know, we dive deep, but at least get the baseline that you can with their support, because they have a lot to offer.
They do. And they can take a lot of those time consuming things that you feel like you don't have time for, but need to get done, off your plate and do those for you. So
actually, you know what? Back to the idea of each team lunch, you're going to invite another team in to present. Invite your marketing and business development team to present at your monthly lunch, your monthly litigation lunch, so they can tell you how they can be a resource.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much. This was a huge conversation. We covered all kinds of areas of business development. I know people will get a lot out of this. Before you leave, you let people know where they can find you.
Sure. So you can find me on LinkedIn, Randy Rosenblatt. You could also email me, Randy, R-A-N-D-I, at upwardstride.com. Either of those ways is great. And I look forward to hearing from you.
And I will put links to all the places where you can be found online in the show notes. Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Are you tired of barely squeezing life in, thinking, shouldn't there be more to life than this? Do you want to get to the next level, but without losing yourself in the process? Are you ready to start thinking and doing differently so that you can stop doing the same things over and over and over, hoping for a different result? If any of this speaks to you and you're ready to do something about it starting now, book a call with me to find out how I can help. Go to lifeandlawpodcast.com/free call.